All right, guys. I think we're going to start. So this panel is expanding the environmental justice tent. And I'm going to introduce our panelists, and maybe I'll start with myself. I am Nikhil Swaminathan. I am a senior editor at Grist, and I lead our environmental justice coverage. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves? Like, you probably know better.
Good morning. My name is Derek Jackson, a energy and climate writing fellow at the Union of Concerned Scientists, formerly a longtime columnist and editorial board member at the Boston Globe, and in a happier version of the environment, I am co-author of a book called Project Puffin, The Restoration of Puffins to the Coast of Maine. So.
My name is Sarah Martick. I'm a community organizer at an environmental justice nonprofit called the Center for Coalfield Justice. We do work predominantly in Greene and Washington counties, which are very rural areas in Pennsylvania. And I'm also a resident of Washington County in a town ironically called Coal Center, which is right by California, Pennsylvania. So.
And my name's Navina Sadasivam, and I'm a staff writer at the Texas Observer. I cover energy and environment for the Observer. We're a magazine. We publish 6 issues a year, and then we also have an online website. And so I'm sort of a beat reporter, but also trying to do features and long-form writing as well.
All right, excellent. So just to begin with, does everybody in this room think they know what environmental justice is? I have a definition, which I'll read, but I don't know if you're familiar with this community, but there's a community in North Carolina called Tillery, and they dealt with waste runoff from a huge buildup of hog farms, and they define EJ as the right to a safe, healthy, productive, and sustainable environment for all, where quote-unquote environment is considered in its totality to include ecological, in parentheses biological, physical, in parentheses natural and built, social, political, aesthetic, and economic environments. Environmental justice refers to the conditions in which such a right can be freely exercised, whereby individual and group identities, needs and dignities are preserved, fulfilled, and respected in a way that provides for self-actualization and personal and community empowerment. This term acknowledges environmental quote-unquote injustice as the past and present state of affairs and expresses the socio-political objectives needed to address them. Made shorter, all stories are environmental justice stories. And so basically what we are going to talk about here is the most expansive possible definition of what environmental justice is. And our goal is to get an understanding of how you tell these stories to reach audiences that are not going to show up at the next Standing Rock. The way I think about it is, my mother, if you tickle her, she will write a check to the Democratic National Committee, and yet she doesn't know what Standing Rock is. So there is a built-in audience for these stories, and we're going to discuss sort of how to get it past them. And so just to start off with, I want to ask sort of one question of each of our panelists, and then we'll go to kind of like a more free-form discussion. So I wanted to start with you, Sarah, because you have the privilege of not being a journalist. And I wanted to know, because you work with communities in Western Pennsylvania, what does the term environmental justice mean to the people you work with? And have they ever heard that term before?
So I would say that as a definition, environmental justice kind of means very little. So as a term, you wouldn't hear that discussed among people in the communities. People who are members of my organization or supporters of CCJ, mm-hmm. they may know what it is more so than everyone else, but it's not something that is widely discussed. Like, oh, we live in an environmental justice zone or area. But they live that life. So if you talk to them about their experiences and different things, they'll be like, oh, yes, this is me. I have something in common with this person who is having this issue. But then there's also this this other part of my community and of rural communities where I live and work in a very red area. So, you know, everyone here went for Trump. Mm-hmm. And when they are kind of attacking back on some of the stories, like EJ issues here deal a lot with energy extraction, they make it kind of ironic, like, oh, you're the Center for Coalfield Justice. This isn't justice. We don't have jobs or things like that. So they kind of attack that part of it. So it can kind of be a vulnerable concept as well.
Okay. Have either you, Navina, or you, Derek, in writing or reporting about environmental justice issues, had any issue with that terminology? Like, had to explain what it is, or do you even use it in your writing or reporting generally?
Yeah, I can speak to that a little bit. In a lot of the stories that I write, I almost try to avoid the term environmental justice, if I can, if it's possible to tell the story truthfully and accurately without using that term, mm-hmm. you know, while explaining, of course, that there's a disproportionate impact on people of color. That's usually what I try to do, because I think in some ways it almost sort of turns people off because they see that, or, you know, the term environmental justice or environmental racism, and they immediately think, oh, this person's, you know, liberal and progressive, and so I want nothing to do with this. And I feel like I can almost see people just like clicking out of my story at that point. So I do try to avoid that. And in terms of like interacting with people in the community and trying to see if whether they understand the term, whether they've heard of the term, I'm actually working on a story right now that involves a lot of gas station owners and how they're unfairly treated by the state. And a lot of gas station owners tend to be immigrants, often of Middle Eastern or South Asian or Asian origins. And in a lot of cases, I like sort of sat down with them and asked them, you know, do you feel like you're being unfairly treated because of your race or your ethnicity or where you come from? And, you know, whether you're able to speak the language, whether you're able to speak English fluently. And they say, no, that has nothing to do with it. Mm-hmm. And then I sort of lay out the stats of, like, you know, this is an immigrant-owned business. And if you compare with larger corporations, they don't get treated the same way. And then sort of things start to click. But I just don't feel like people want to be seen as victims. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, I think there's almost a shying away from it. So I was actually out in the field reporting earlier this week, and that's something that struck me, that people kind of, across the board, I was expecting that people would be able to sort of articulate that and say, you know, I think that's right. I don't think, like, the business across the street is owned by this giant corporation, and I don't think they face the same issues that we do. And I think, you know, part of it has to do with the fact that they're sort of, you know, owned by rich white people. And I thought that I might hear some of that, maybe not in that exact same language, but some of it. But I almost found across the board people sort of pushing that away, you know, saying, look, I came here to this country to work hard and to set up a business, and they just don't view themselves that way.
Mm-hmm.
So that was interesting to see.
Well, I mean, that's interesting, and I want to know how kind of widespread that is. And maybe this is a good moment to kind of pivot to two really big environmental justice stories that sort of broke mainstream in the last couple years, and those are Flint and Standing Rock. And maybe we can spend some time like sort of pulling those apart and seeing kind of how we got to where we are. In terms of coverage of those stories, and Derek is sort of our resident expert. He wrote a very comprehensive kind of assessment of how Flint coverage moved from local media to national media. And I was interested in kind of what it takes, like how from everything that you consumed with regards to how the Flint story played out, How did that community see themselves, and what did it take for that story to move from a Flint story or a a Michigan story to a national?
Great question. And before I give my answer, the answer I really want to give, I also kind of started with, was anybody in the panel that I was speaking on yesterday? So that I'm at risk of over-repeating what I said yesterday. Emily, will it be offensive to you if I read what I read yesterday? Okay. So the big punchline for... So I did a Shorenstein Fellowship at the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard last fall, and my paper was the national media's failure to cover the Flint water crisis. And the and when I say failure, the failure is primarily in context and quality, and of course timeliness. And I'm going to read you about a 6-paragraph excerpt, which is my core argument. To give you a little timeline, the state of Michigan to save money made Flint switch from the city of Detroit's water supply from Lake Huron to the Flint River, which everybody knew historically was one of the most corrosive rivers in America. The people, local people, almost immediately complained of smells, irritations, rashes, orange water, brown water, and were actually writing letters to the editor. The local press, bless them, the Ron Fonger of the Flint Journal, then Michigan Public Radio, Kurt Guyette of the American Civil Liberties Union of Michigan. They were on the case documenting day by day, week by week, what was going on. But the national media, and then the coup de grace was that in October, General Motors took their plant off of Flint water because it was rusting engine parts in real time. And yet that did not attract national media attention. The first major national coverage was 11 months later by the New York Times. And that's the context that I'm going to read to you about. And after that, there was voluminous national coverage, but I think it was the wrong kind of coverage. And here's my argument, if it's okay with you. But the Times parachuting into the crisis, the New York Times, missed things that would have made the story more urgent. And I should probably just say, to the surface reader, they quoted a few residents, and they gave equal time to the state and local officials. And there was no mention of the months of marches and frigid weather. There was no mention of the many bottled water giveaways in which all sectors of local society participated, Catholic charities to Muslim ex-prisoners, and from CEOs to secretaries. While emergency manager Ambrose and Mayor Walling were granted 6 paragraphs to say the water was safe and they were doing everything they could, there was not a single quote or single identification of any of the local politicians who for months challenged the proclamations of safety from the mayor and the state-appointed city manager. The story mentioned General Motors in the history of Flint, but made no mention, I repeat, no mention, of the company fleeing from Flint's water because of the rusting engine parts. It made no mention of the Children's Museum telling children not to drink the water. It missed the Facebook communities being formed to protest the water and letters to the mayor and to the editor of the Flint Journal. After a strong opening with Melissa Mays, one of the victims of it, this Times story made no more attempts with other residents to lay out the broad array of irritations and illnesses besetting the population. Adding it all together, the space given Ambrose and Walling compared to just one sentence given to city council members who voted to go back to the Detroit water system, the omission of red flags such as the rusted GM parts, and the absence of any narrative that the people themselves in Flint from almost day one of the switch were pushing back and pulling together, gave the first national story of the Flint water crisis the appearance of granting far too much deference to those in power. That would seem to violate the Society of Professional Journalists' code of ethics for newspapers to quote, give voice to the voiceless, as well as Finley Peter Dunn's admonition more than a century ago for the press to afflict the comfortable and comfort the afflicted. The downplaying of community action by the Times, however unintentional, may have created a self-fulfilling lack of urgency, and I would add a lack of urgency in all the national media. For neither that newspaper nor any other major newspaper or television station outside of Michigan would return to visit the story of the Flint water crisis for another half year.
That's shocking, obviously, especially given like what we know now. What I'm wondering, and this is sort of goes for a lot of EJ stories, because we just talked about how expansive the definition of EJ actually is that there was an opportunity to flip this from a business story into an environmental justice story at that General Motors point. And so something that Navina and I were talking about was that might have actually been what brought the story around Standing Rock and the Dakota Access Pipeline into real view. Not even the protests themselves, but you put it this way, that ended up not really being a pure EJ story. It was almost like piggybacking off of the things that had happened in Ferguson and in other parts of the country, right?
Yeah, that's what it seemed like to me, at least. You know, early on in the first couple of months, there were protests happening, and a lot of it was covered by alt weeklies and small blogs and other, you know, non-traditional media outlets like Truthout, for instance. And it was circulating within the environmental community. I felt like the point at which it really took off is when a lot of the videos started emerging of police clashing with the protesters, and that felt like a narrative that, you know, folks understood, and that was sort of already in the public consciousness, this idea of police using excessive force with people of color. That seemed like something that was already, you know, people were familiar with. And so when they saw that and they recognized that, that's when it really sort of took off on Twitter and on Facebook. And at that point, you know, the national media outlets couldn't ignore the story anymore. And so that's when we saw the New York Times and Washington Post and CNN and everybody sort of descend on Standing Rock. And then there was, of course, the media frenzy and everything that came with that.
Yeah, I would like to second that, Navina, that that's precisely one of the biggest blind spots of the media today, which is it waits until people of color, low-income people are in a defensive posture before then they cover it. This is exactly what happened in Flint. The national media ignored the actual agency of the people themselves. I mean, from day one, the people of Flint were trying to use every lever of personal voice, collective voice, and what democratic levers of government they had in a city that had been taken over by the state, to say, this water's horrible. Remedy this. This is not right. And by the time the national media came, the overwhelming narrative of the national media was that all these people were just victims. And they granted them really no power until the poisoning of the children was basically validated by white physicians. Well, there was one famous Iraqi American, but there was no major black voice, you know, who was considered a hero. So the narrative became a classic stereotype that represents kind of the longest standing historic failure of the media to understand people of color, people among class, and using their voice to detect when power has overstepped its bounds before the conflict happens.
Right, right. And I think the bar for environmental stories about people of color is so much higher, right? You have to show that people are actually getting hurt. You know, people are, you know, they're putting their bodies between and being, you know, hurt by bullets and there's tear gas. And sort of we need to see that. It feels like the public needs to see that before they recognize, oh, I see, this is a there's a story here that needs to be told. So it just feels like the bar is so much higher when it comes to stories about people of color.
And I think in Flint there was a sense that, I mean, this sort of played out in Flint because, as Derek notes in his assessment of the Flint coverage, yes, Melissa Mays was covered, but the, is it Leanne Wright? Is that the name of the... the woman who had her children tested? I'm trying to remember what her name
was. There were several who had their kids tested, but Melissa Mays.
There was a white family, as I recall, that was heavily featured.
Melissa Mays's family.
Okay.
Yeah. Leanne Walters.
Leanne Walters. Okay, Leanne Walters' family. And this is in a city that is 60% Black. So as a journalist, are you telling the correct story if Leanne Walters' family, who has, you know, obviously, like, nobody should have lead in their water, but are you telling a story that is accurate to what's going on the ground if that's your lead character?
Not at all.
Surprise, surprise. No one saw that coming.
Yeah, I mean, I know of a couple people who were at the session I was in yesterday have heard this, but it should be absolutely shocking to the journalistic conscience that not a single, quote, hero of the Flint water crisis as described, literally, quote, as hero, unquote, by the national press, not a single African-American received a repeated mention as a, quote, hero. Interestingly, British press, Al Jazeera English, BBC, foreign press, found the time and the energy and the journalistic broadness of mind to go talk to Black residents and call the Black Ministers Alliance in Flint, called the leaders of that heroes. There was a Muslim ex-con who was leading water bottle drives. Foreign media called him a hero. Yet the American press never called any of these people a hero. So that leads to this thing. Flint really exposed how in-depth, how it still remains invisibly wedded to what's been described as the white hero narrative.
So what do you do then as you come into a community and you're, you know, trying to assess how to tell a story? I mean, you know, race is a background on a lot of environmental justice stories, but it's not the background on every one of them. So if I was coming into, say, Western Pennsylvania to talk to the communities that you work with, Sarah, I think one of the things that we touched on here was that a lot of times you have to take an environmental justice story and kind of marry it to another narrative. So as Navina said in Standing Rock, it was police militarization and brutality. And in Flint, the opportunity was missed to tell a story that was based on, if this water is rusting, car parts in real time, should people really be drinking it? So I'm curious, like, from your advocacy standpoint, when you're working with your communities, are you constantly having to look for, like, areas of synergy, like ways in which this is, like, a justice issue, but it's also a local economic issue?
So in the communities in which I work, they are predominantly white communities. Mm-hmm. Whenever you are working with communities that have people of color in them, there's usually like either like there's a group of people where I live who are everyone in that group is are black.
Mm-hmm.
And what they are dealing with right now is leasing companies are coming in and saying, sign this lease, let us frack on the land. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times they rent as mm-hmm. opposed to own the property. So then it's a question of who has the right to lease that land, the person who lives on it, or the person you know, who owns the actual property.
Mm-hmm.
But that's kind of a more systemic issue than just fracking in mm-hmm. Pennsylvania. So you can intersect there. And in rural communities, it does go back a lot to property rights because there you have so much land. As opposed to in Pittsburgh, it's a little bit different when you're downtown and there's just not the land to have.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really important. And then in a lot of our work, because we do advocate and we try to educate people, so we have to show that there are intersections with different issues. So, you know, our demographic might be mostly white,
mm-hmm.
but Pittsburgh and the surrounding area where we live, our pipes were installed at the same time as the pipes in Flint were. So maybe that's a story that has people of color in it, and people don't think that that's going to apply to them, but it does.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be that's something that we in Pittsburgh are looking at now, and you know, we realize that there is a problem with lead in our water,
uh-huh.
And it's affecting people everywhere. So just making people aware of the stories and saying it doesn't matter who the subjects are necessarily. They're human beings who are struggling with an issue, and this affects you as well.
Right.
So educating that way is important too.
Right. And I had an interesting conversation with Mustafa Ali, who was until recently the head of environmental justice at the EPA. And he, in a weird way, kind of inspired this panel because he was talking about how ultimately when you are reporting on environmental justice, you are reporting on people's basic human rights to clean air, clean water, clean soil. And so that, you know, being true, I think that when we internally, like journalists internally, are talking about these subjects, a lot of times we use, you know, the terms environmental justice, environmental racism. How do you guys decouple, or can you decouple those two terms, like as you're thinking through stories, or are those two just sort of part of the same coin?
Well, I don't think I've ever used the term environmental racism in my stories, unless it's in a quote, unless someone's telling me that and I'm quoting them. And I, you know, one of the reasons I think we don't call anything racist in any of our stories unless it's an opinion piece. And that's really because it's just such, it's not a word to use lightly, and also it's not, it for our organization at least, we don't feel like it's our place to say that unless someone else is saying it, you know. So that phrase, that terminology is just sort of off the table. Environmental racism, environmental injustice, or you know, environmental justice, that term I do try to avoid in my stories unless it is just sort of unavoidable or, you know, absolutely necessary. And again, you know, like I mentioned, it's just because I think we don't want to always be preaching to the choir, right? We want our stories to be read more widely.
Mm-hmm.
And at The Observer, you know, we're already a progressive magazine. And, you know, a lot of people in Texas will not read us because they think of us as, you know, oh, that liberal rag, we know what they're going to say. So we've already, you know, cut off a bunch of our readership just because of, you know, who we are and our tradition.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if there's something that I can do to get my stories out there and be read by a wider audience, then I'm going to try and do that.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the times I think, you know, features are really helpful in getting these environmental justice stories out because you can find characters, you can build a narrative arc, there's drama in those stories, and that's always attractive, right? And so I try to you know, write stories that, you know, if there's a conservative person reading the story, they might not even realize that they're reading a story about environmental justice till the very end. Or maybe they'll just, like, never realize it, and I'm okay with that. Like, you know, you've read my story, you got the point, and you understand that this community is being disproportionately affected because of X, Y, and Z. I don't need you to agree with me on a lot of, like, on the politics of that, mm-hmm. right? So in some ways, I feel like it's an advantage to try and avoid those terms.
Well, since I'm an opinionated writer, I have zero problem calling something environmental racism if I think it's warranted. I do think, so we're at a moment of a delicate dance. The dance being that already in its sort of early usage in common language as a term, environmental justice. Environmental justice pretty clearly to me has been ghettoized as referring only to people of color and poor people of color. That said, those of us in this profession have an obligation to fight for that definition if it's merited, and not shy away from that definition. Should not miss opportunities as well to find synergies, such as what you're experiencing in with Coalfield Justice, because huge percentages of white Americans also live with asthma and toxic, living near bad air, toxic sites, et cetera. Even as the zip code, every zip code study shows that the likelihood of a poor person of color is much higher to live by these things. We have to, it's a both and. Some of this stuff affects everybody. And even as we try to say that, you also have to, everybody has to also be mindful that even if government was the antenna of government and other resources are raised by the fact that these environmental harms affect everybody, the history still is that the remedy disproportionately goes to wealthy and white. As one of my favorite quotes in the paper I wrote for the Kennedy School came from one of the top, the nation's longest standing environmental justice experts, a woman named Beverly Wright of Dillard University in the Deep South Center for Environmental Justice down in New Orleans. And I'll read the quote. She says it better than I can paraphrase it. When have you seen the big movie about environmental disasters in a black community or a Latino community? You had a movie on the BP Horizon. You had Aaron Brockovich. You had Woburn. In spite of all the suffering and numerous stories available about what is happening in black communities, we don't see anything that reaches that level of attention. Wright, for that matter, could have added the national coverage of Three Mile Island, Love Canal, Times Beach, Missouri, things that I see people nodding their heads so they remember them. But very few people in America know, for instance, about how Latinos, the scores of Latino homeowners, their homes are literally abut tanks in Houston, Texas. So I think, again, it's a dance where those of us who have the ability, we both have to really forcefully call out environmental injustice or injustice. That's even the better term, is environmental injustice. Wherever it is, and call a spade, whenever that is. Try to, unify when you can, but always be mindful of the other thing. And I would just close on this. I was quite moved yesterday in a negative way. Even Steve Curwood in the plenary session had this passionate moment of asking the panel their response to the racial aggressiveness of the Trump administration as regards environmental issues. And not a single member of that panel responded to his comments. In fact, it became an all. The audience did. The audience, there was applause in the audience, but it was stunning to hear the very next response was, well, environmental reporters are abused too. And I was like, wait a minute, let's not, what environmental journalists matter to? And so I think that, you know, that's how deep the unconscious is of dealing with these issues. I mean, it's really great that this is coming to the fore. At least for panels and whatnot. And so this gives us a chance to really think about, you know, what that means and how we need to, all of us, have to rearrange our brains so that we can identify these issues for what they are at a particular time.
Right.
Sorry.
And, I mean, to sort of piggyback on Steve Kerwood's point, you know, this is a moment in time where the discussion of race has been pushed very far back into the forefront as a result of the Trump administration. And also, actually, what it's also done is lay the groundwork for a lot of kind of negative stories about environmental injustice, regulations being pulled back, you know, whatever the hell Scott Pruitt is doing at the EPA, that kind of situation, you know, there's an opportunity right now for us as journalists to point out injustice or things that were held together by, you know, some MacGyver setup that are about to fall apart because of our current stewardship. But I'm wondering if there is a market out there for more positive stories, because there are communities that have, you know, advocates like the Center for Coalfield Justice, and, you know, there are strong communities, I know, in New York and in California that are actually, like, on the ground trying to make change. So one thing that I'm wondering is one way to break through the, or get your story across the transom to, like, a new audience, to tell a story where there's progress being made instead of to just point at a community and be like, here's another one. We found another community being screwed over. Like, is there an appetite, maybe even right now, at a sort of generally negative moment in American history to have, like, some uplift?
You want to go first, Navina? I have one, but you want to go first? I just talked a while, so go ahead.
Yeah, no. It's a hard one. I think, you know, if you're, as a reporter, like, if you're coming across a story where a community is being affected, it's hurting, and it's a story of environmental justice, and there are no clear solutions, and it's not a very positive story, and it sounds maybe similar to other stories that you've written, I personally try not to say, okay, well, I've told that story before about this other community, I'm gonna like let this one go. I do try very hard to find a new angle, to find something interesting to say, even if it is negative. That being said, I think there definitely is an appetite for solutions-based journalism. I know that there's at least one foundation out there that actively, like, funds projects about not only reporting about the problem, but then also showing what the solution might be. And I think, yeah, personally, as a reporter who covers this issue and is, you know, depressing as hell, it would be nice every now and then to find a positive angle and to write about something uplifting. And surely there must be a way to do both. I really would shy away from saying that, you know, just because a story is negative, you know, you let it go because it's maybe a story that's very familiar to people or people have heard about it. You know, if that community hasn't received a lot of press, you might be actually doing a service. Mm. And you might be actually able to create some change or impact as a result.
I feel like both kinds of stories have merit and purpose on their own. So for people in my community who say there isn't a problem, this is not an injustice, you know, having these stories that are negative really sucks to read, but it is helpful to kind of keep keep pushing that, and if you can find more angles to expand on why it's such a terrible thing and why people should care, that is very helpful from an organizing standpoint, because you can get more people involved and caring about the issues and hopefully mobilize people to affect some change. But then for people who are who have been struggling with these injustices for a long time, it is hard to keep reading that there's just more injustice all the time. So having stories where there was something that was effective, and that was uplifting, and something good happened as a result, that's really nice to see. For example, there's in my community in Greene County, CONSOL Energy kind of props up the entire economy. Mm-hmm. And so the question is, if coal mining stops because of all the regulations, or because of natural gas, or because green energy, what happens to this community? But there are other communities who have gone through this, a lot in Kentucky with mountaintop removal, coal mining, things like that, and they've started to figure it out. They might not have a perfect system, but there's a group, Kentuckians for the Commonwealth, and they've done a ton of work in making sure that they have a more diverse economy. So seeing what they have done and seeing how that would work in our community helps a lot of my work. Mm-hmm. And it's something that we can push out to people saying, here's an alternative. Here's something we could do to help. What do you think? Because when we've done listening projects in the past and we say, okay, so if CONSOL is not here, what kind of work do you want to do? We get a lot of blank faces. Mm-hmm. Because people don't know. They have no idea what else they could do that would bring in any kind of income and let them support their family and live in the house that they just paid off or things like that. So there's a lot of different issues there. But seeing both kinds of stories is very effective. Mm-hmm. Mm.
One of the nice things about working with the Union of Concerned Scientists is that they've had me going around the country doing some positive stories about people of color getting involved in renewable energy. And I did a piece which actually was printed in all places, ESPN's The Undefeated website, in their cultural portal, because I made the pitch to them that this was kind of an out-of-the-box piece that would kind of show that, yeah, black people care about solar power, too. And so I went to California, New Orleans, Brooklyn, New York, and Washington, Southeast D.C., in the poorest wards, where by various state and city programs, significant parts of townhouse developments or neighborhoods are getting solar power. And for them, it's interesting. The language of getting solar power is, it originally had nothing to do, and I'm being a little bit dramatic saying this, very little to do with going green, which is the standard mainstream, let's go green, let's go solar. For them, it was all about saving money. But once they started saving money, the going green part, kind of kicks in, and they feel a little pride of being part of that mainstream narrative. So part of the issue is, they might have a slightly different narrative to broaden some of these issues. There's a Latino group in Chicago that originally formed to fight shut down a fossil fuel burning plant, and they succeeded in that, but they moved beyond that community organizing didn't end when the plant got shut down. They moved on to park restoration, getting good city lights to light their neighborhood, trees, having trees planted. So I think you're right. There's, there's stories to tell. Again, and I use that word agency. The key is those stories almost always by definition involve people, the press, having to take on this role of recognizing that people care and they want to care, and let's cover them when they care.
And I also just want to add, I think reporters have this tendency, especially when you've been on a beat for a while, everything starts to feel familiar. you've seen the same sort of story play out 100 times, right? But just because you're familiar with it and your editor is familiar with it doesn't mean that your readers are. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to sort of recognize that just because something is familiar to you and you've seen the story, you know, in the New York Times and everywhere else, that's not a reason to not do the story. I think it's a reason just to, like, try to find a new angle, try to find something different to say about the same issue, try to find new people who are already, you know, in that community who are experiencing those problems. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, that should be a motivating force instead of a reason to sort of step back and say, okay, I'm not going to do the story.
Okay, so I think we have about 25 minutes or so before lunch, and I've been told to let you all go right at noon. So I wanted to offer an opportunity for Q&A. So if anybody has any questions, I think, you know, we sort of want to treat this as like kind of an incubator for ideas for getting these stories out farther. So anything that you... If you just want to offer an idea as opposed to ask us a question, since we clearly don't have all the answers, we just have some ideas of our own.
Hi, I'm Bill Kavarik with Radford University, Virginia Tech. Mm-hmm. And the idea we've been kicking around in another session and after has to do with expanding the reach of media from just the cloistered professionals into empowering the communities with their own media and finding an intersection there. So maybe that's a point that some of the speakers could address. How can you empower communities more with their own media?
Okay, so just to make sure everybody heard about that, it's sort of bringing the media to the people or giving them the voice to tell their own stories. So... I know, Sarah, you probably have a ton to say about this because you were telling me nobody in your region reads Grist, which made me really sad.
Yeah, but. I'm really sorry. So there are a couple different things that I could say in response to that. So the first thing is the least expensive way for people to get their news is usually through cable that they already pay for. So watching things or you know, looking online, that's probably where they're going. If this is any kind of subscription service, people can't necessarily afford to. Like, I didn't have a subscription to the New York Times until it went on sale, like 50% off right after the election. And so now I read it, the New York Times, but I'm one of the few people in my community that does. People are most likely to read their local paper. You can't get the Times or the Post or anything like that delivered same day here in our rural communities. You can in downtown Pittsburgh, but that's only downtown. So if you want to get the stories to people to read, then it has to be more at a local level. And also it can't be cost prohibitive to read it. So if your stories are only available to people, for a cost for low-income folks, regardless of color or anything like that, it's difficult for them to read. So those are important.
One thing we've been trying to do at The Observer is try to find community leaders or people who've been through some sort of experience to actually write for us. And again, as a magazine, I think there's a space for that. And so we did this recently with DACA, where we had a young gentleman from Nepal who had a PhD, who studied in the United States, got a PhD here, and then was never able to gain citizenship or maintain his legal status here. And so he basically immigrated to Canada and, like, got citizenship in 2 years and is settled there and, you know, moved his whole family out there. So we got him to talk about what his experience was like as an immigrant. And I think those stories tend to resonate with the community, too, because it feels familiar. It's first person, and so there's... they might be more connected, and it might get circulated in those communities more. And that also, I think, helps build trust, because then they see The Observer as a space where, you know, we're willing to feature people of color, you know, in our stories. And so I think that helps build trust with the communities as well.
Yes.
Sorry.
I'm on staff.
Bay Nature. Okay.
And we cover pretty exclusively nature, wildlife, conservation issues. And it's always felt to me like we're need to be reaching a broader audience. You know, the Bay Area is very diverse. Like, we shouldn't just be covering issues that that a certain, just a very limited community wants to know about. But at the same time, you know, we kind of have this angle that works, and we have this niche in terms of what our coverage. And I'm wondering, and we've had talked about, like, should we cover, you know, more well-being, health issues related to our access to nature, you know, and social justice issues related to our access to nature and parks. And we're starting to get there. We really are. We're probably, like, toxins are probably not, like, at least the first layer of expansion in our coverage and our interest in terms of our readership building. But I'm just wondering if you guys have any advice on how, you know, a very, we're very Caucasian in our leadership, in our staff, and everything, how we can start to sort of branch out a bit more and be, you know, bring in other voices and how, without, like, necessarily, like, taking on the beat of covering oil refineries, which is not something that we're going to be doing right away, at least.
Okay, I'm just going to summarize that. So you work at Bay Nature with my friend Victoria, I'm sure. Very well. We talked on Tuesday, actually. So you're wondering sort of how you expand your coverage to bring in more justice topics when you're a sort of recreational nature type magazine. So I don't know if anybody, Derek, was...
I think one suggestion, if that was a question of how, is I think your editors and board might want to challenge, you know, what is your definition of conservation? What is your definition of whatever it is you think you cover now? So you're in the Bay Area. I immediately leapt to the fact that, I mean, you're in the land where Van Jones, you know, got all the solar revolution started of getting low-income people jobs, putting solar power on top of people's roofs, and job training. I mean, that's like the first job training kind of initiative in the country. I consider that conservation. I mean, I consider that getting people involved, low-income, middle, working-class people, taking pride with solar, and the first thought in their head is it lowers my bills. But then again, later on, then they take pride. I was in a neighborhood in San Diego. I mean, you may have Broadway Heights, primarily black community in a area of San Diego that they reclaimed from the drug dealers. And turned into a solid working class, upper, lower middle class community, of which today out of 192 homes, 80 or so have solar power. And the guy who's their neighborhood president, he says, you know, I want the city of San Diego to declare us an eco district. And so... it would, for that, some, if there was like a story like that, I would imagine that ought to be like a slam dunk for a publication. Like, so I think that the issue is, if groups like yours truly want to diversify their readership and interest in your product, you by definition have to broaden and diversify your definition of what it is you're currently publishing.
Yeah, and I'll just really quickly add, because I've actually had this conversation with the editor of your magazine, that it doesn't have to be, you don't have to have like a justice issue, you know, next summer. It can be a slow build of finding, you know, people of color in the Bay Area who are experiencing, who are doing conservation type work, and then just talking to them about their experience coming at it versus what your normal reader, what their experience is and their background and their relationship with nature. So I think there's a lot of, you don't have to like wholesale become an EJ publication. You can just, you know, include it in your mission and drop it in from here, you know, here and there, and just, you know, expand your publication's kind of worldview a little bit in that respect.
Yeah, I want to add, I think EJ stories are best when they sort of develop organically. So I would suggest, you know, trying to find the communities where people of color live and then try to attend their meetings, go to neighborhood association meetings, start attending those, you know, maybe they have a website and they're posting agendas, keep track of that. Maybe they have Facebook groups where these conversations are happening. Try to embed yourself. So, you know, before seeking out a story, I would just suggest, you know, try to sort of embed yourself in that community and see what's going on. And then that automatically will lead to stories, for sure. You know, there's no question about it. I think so initial steps need to be sort of to find the communities and to find sources and to just sort of, you know, not be working off of this idea that I have a deadline and I need to find a story, but just to sort of, you know, settle in a little bit. Yeah.
That's a good point.
So my name is Rocky Kistner. I'm a multimedia reporter in D.C. There's so much to talk about here, but first of all, I want to commend all of you for your work, and it's incredibly important.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. It's really important. I've been doing covering this issue, environmental journalism, EJ work for, 30 years, and for networks, for print, for magazines, whatever. I don't see a lot of change in 30 years. I feel like we are at this moment in time. I mean, I had lunch with an EPA official a couple of months ago. He says, we are at war, and there is no longer the rule of law inside the EPA. Mm-hmm. Given that, and I believe that we have to think outside the box here. You know, we cannot just keep plodding along and doing this. I mean, I know your publication is doing a lot. The local community is really important. But I think this question about empowering these voices is really important. And we have the technology to do it. You know, when I was embedded in the Gulf doing the BP thing for 7 months, the fishing community there rose together and created a Facebook community that actually did drive their voices out to the media, not as much as maybe it could have been. But I'm just curious from your perspective, how as journalists can we do a better job of helping promote that and using these social media tools to get these voices into the discussion?
Okay, so just to summarize that, how do you get voices on the ground, like community voices, like how do you use your reporting or social media or other tools, the internet, to get the what's going on the ground, what community members are feeling out to people, especially at this harrowing time where the EPA is sort of not minding the shop?
One thing that I'm sort of a huge advocate for is to make sure that you're going beyond just the usual folks from a community that you might hear from, trying to find new voices within that community so that, you know, I sometimes land on a story, you know, a month or two after there's been some reporting and, you know, you talk to advocates and the advocates all sort of point to the same community organizer or person in the community for you to talk to. And then that becomes your lead. And so it's very formulaic. And so I try to find new folks within that community who might have just as powerful of a story to tell. So that's one way is, you know, to do more legwork is to find new people within the community. So that's one thing that I think is helpful. And then to, of course, you know, try to push that out on Twitter, push that out on Facebook as much as you can. You know, talk to your digital editor and make sure that there's, you know, prominent placing. Try as best as you can to push for prominent placing on your website. Make sure that they're, you know, doing tweet storms about it just as they would for any other feature or for any other story. Trying to work with your digital editor, I think, is really key in that sense. If you have an audience development person at your publication, trying to work with them is helpful because often sometimes what happens sometimes is that your digital editor, your audience development person is not as familiar with these issues. And so when they're not familiar, they're less likely to tweet about it just as often, or, you know, less likely to push it out as much. So work with them, help develop like a Google Doc of tweets and posts and things that you can use to maybe push that story out. I think that's helpful.
And one thing that we do at Grist, like Grist has a national or beyond focus, and we try not to, especially with our EJ coverage, and it's something that we're still working to perfect, we try not to parachute into communities, try to learn what the hell is going on in a complex system, and then tell that story. We try to find voices, people, journalists who are at who live in an area to tell the story of that area, because their learning curve is much flatter. And I think that there's a lot of, especially, I mean, you're a multimedia guy, so when you're presenting a story, it doesn't just have to be three sections of 500 words that make up a 1500 word story. You can drop in, you know, a Facebook post from a community member that really like describes what's going on the ground. You can drop in, like, we drop in tweets all the time. You know, we've been like, we've had this like little idea, like, percolating around, at least since I got to Grist, where I was wondering if those like little flip cameras that like were popular for like a decade ago, and like I assume smartphones killed them. I bet there's like a warehouse of them somewhere, and we could just send them to EJ communities and have them like, you know, film what's going on and then send it back to us. Don't steal that idea. Yeah. But
I guess part of my question really is more, what can these people do on their own, you know, to get their stories out to the media, to us, in a better way and facilitate the transfer of information?
I mean, I think we need to make it clear that we're open for business.
Yeah.
You know, open your DMs if you're on Twitter all the time. You know, as much as you don't want to, read the comments on your stories, because sometimes somebody's going to be like, hey, this exact thing is happening in my community. And so it's up to you as a journalist to like to expand your net. And so after you read like the 10 comments of people telling you you're an idiot, there's probably like one person in there who's like, come here. Like, I have a story for you to tell.
Yeah, I want to second what Naveen and Nikhil have said. I'll let my younger colleagues speak to social media usage. But I can't overemphasize enough to Nikhil's point and Naveena's point that we have to remember that we in the media, black, white, polka dot, long before Donald Trump tried to discredit us, we discredited ourselves among disenfranchised people. There's never been anything remotely close to a high level of trust of mainstream media parachuting into black, brown, polka dot communities of any least disenfranchisement. So we always have to remember that. And so while this may seem a bit facile, I always had a rule in my head. I did plenty of parachuting as a national reporter for Newsday many years ago, and then as a columnist at the Boston Globe, I often went to places that other people already have been. And my rule in my head was, whatever, I always looked with the aid of NexusLexis, I always made sure that if the person I was quoting or interviewing had already been quoted by somebody else, I always made it a point to ask the person, who else do you know? It sounds like a simple question, and it led to gold mines of really great quotes over the years for various kinds of stories. We just have to go that extra mile. And every time you ask that question, you build trust that person by person. It is not easy to go into places that have been historically, I mean, as much as I criticize the national media for its coverage of Flint, it didn't have to be that. Even when they parachuted, had they gone that extra mile to talk to the black pastor, to talk to the Muslim ex-con who was delivering water and raise him or her up to be a hero in the crisis, I would have been cool with that. But, you know, that's another way of saying the national media was lazy. And so if we're going to cover, it doesn't matter whether it's EJ or brain injuries in football, we have to go that extra step to gain the trust and then gain the credibility so that when our stories are printed or published or aired, that the people of those communities look at it and say, I was validated, I was represented positive, not that you got an award from some organization. There are many people who gotten awards, but the people of the community couldn't give a rat's you know what. You know? So
I'm wondering, Sarah, do you have just anything to add about how communities can contact us or kind of would a place like Center for Coalfield Justice, you know, facilitate that sort of interaction?
I mean, as much as we have the capacity to do so, for sure. I think so. Some things that that we get frustrated with when we do need help from the media for things is whether or not something is newsworthy. So it might be the same story. It might be again that like, oh, there's another well pad going in this place, or the pipeline is going through this community again. And as much as it's not interesting to people with degrees in journalism, it's something that whoever is impacted by it are having these issues. So if you've already written a story about that, write another story about it and link them together. And that could create, you know, connections between the people who are having those experiences. And then that in and of itself could grow and be something that is more newsworthy. So questioning whether or not something is, you know, something that your editor is going to like, makes it difficult for some stories to get out at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of, you know, if you just went around with your phone, just little videos of people in your community and just post it on your website, mm-hmm. I think that could be a very powerful tool to get folks out there like me to know who these people are and, you know, maybe go interview.
Yeah.
Now, I was asked Sarah a question, so I was trying to get a little snack, but can you think of a time, a story that was done in your community, the people you're advocating for, that they looked at that story and said, that's me? And we were depicted properly.
So you mean about the one that was written about my community? Okay, So I could say there was a piece in The New Yorker that actually featured the executive director of CCJ. Her name is Veronica, and she lives in Greene County, and a lot of our work centers on Ryerson Station State Park and mining that is happening in and around it that's affecting water. So as much as she's the ED of my organization, but she's also a community member. And Eliza, I think her last name is Fitzgerald, but Eliza Fitzgerald did the reporting on that story. And literally everything in it was beautifully reported on. And she took a lot of time to interview anyone who had any potential mention or reference in the story, and to check a lot of the sources, and then also make sure that anything that Veronica said was very much reported as it was, with very little editing to the quotes themselves. So that was really a good piece. And she also brought in like a community member who is very antagonistic to my organization, and that helped create a bigger picture of the world that we live in and the way that we as a group operate within the community. So that was a really good piece if you've read it or if you want to.
They do good work there.
Yeah.
One other thing is also to make sure that you solicit feedback after your stories have published. Make sure you go back to the people you interviewed and send them the story. Like, send them an email and say, hey, what do you think of this? Call them up on the phone and, like, really listen to what they have to say. And, like, make sure that they understand that you're willing to listen and you're looking for feedback. What also helps is also being part of those Facebook groups, and often what will happen is that story will get shared on that Facebook group and people will comment on it. Like, look for that, and there will be criticism in there. You know, sometimes it's really harsh and very hard for you to process, but it's you know, something to learn from.
All right, everybody looks really hungry. And I have to let you go anyway. So I will at least mill around, and maybe a couple of us will. I know Sarah has a packed day, but if you want to reach her, I have her email address, and we'll share it with anybody who wants it. Thank you so much.